Well, good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
And again, big thank you to Jesse for putting this together. And again, really helping come up with the idea of habits of faith. And that is that each one of us needs to think, regardless of what our faith is, because we really all have the same God. And that same God is telling us that we all need to do something. And it's not enough to believe, which is nice and wonderful and important, but it is not the end. It's simply the beginning. It's the beginning of the relationship with God, not the end of the relationship with God. And the beginning of a relationship with God is doing godly acts, acting in a godly way. And so therefore, we have been focusing on the habits of faith. So this class, hopefully you've been going away with homework. And that homework is a habit to change 1, 2, 3, hopefully 6, at least 6 habits. But if you just change 1 a year, that's already a good step and a good way to go. And so tonight, we're going to tackle another habit. But before we do that, I would like to review last week's habits and see if anybody has any feedback for us. And so last week's habit had to do with the way we treat and view other people, and that we need to view other people in a positive way, not to see them as a flaw, but to see them as a person that has a flaw, and that they, as a person, should not change. And so I was just wondering if anybody would like to share. Somehow somebody incorporated that into their week. Yes?
Well, it's actually a difficult situation, but I think I've applied this habit before. Got a call from the East Coast, someone who kind of putting himself in the position of caretaker. I guess he likes to caretake people. And I used to like to do that too. And so he was informing me of something that was going on with my sister, and he was taking it upon himself to sort of kind of wedge himself between something that really wasn't his business to do. In my opinion, it had, you know, nobody was directing him to do it. He was taking it upon himself and speaking for someone else. And I chose not to do anything about the call, although he was directing me that I might like to do something. I was annoyed with the call, but I saw myself in him.
Mm.
I understood that,
wow.
You know, I've certainly been a caretaker, too, to a fault. I try not to do that. And I knew that if it didn't have my name on it, there was nothing that I needed to do about it. And I talked to some people, and he said, accountability, I'm in something similar. And got some feedback and talked it over. So I think that helped people in reading things out. But I don't have any lower opinion of him. I simply see that that's where he is on his path.
And you also saw it in yourself.
I saw that that's something I definitely dislike in my past that I used to do. I try not to.
Wow. Beautiful.
Putting it in place, but it really helped me because I just finished a 6-month lay counseling class for a church. So I'm doing lay counseling at a church. And it made me realize that with what you were saying, that, you know, there's flaws are going to be easy to see, and they're going to be easy to make judgments on, and that you need to really be careful, because it's, you know, there's always two sides. obvious one way or another. You just got to be really aware of your side, what's going on, and kind of put yourself in the mentors or two that you want to be picked on.
Not jumping to conclusions. First we'll go back there, yeah?
Like the next day after this class, maybe 2 days after this class, I heard that a friend of mine who had been divorced from his wife and had 2 kids because of infidelity on his part has been paying child support for the last 8 months. And that typically my response would be to push through and ask questions or something like that. I don't see this guy very often, so I just kind of give the benefit of the doubt. Let it end there. Hopefully
when I see him, not the first thing that, you know, comes to the surface is asking questions, but it's kind of hard. I would imagine that in your position it's a very hard thing to dismiss those pictures that other people have planted in you. And again, because you're not the judge or the jury. If I was the rabbi who was deciding a case, and it says that actually in the Torah, that once the decision is made, even the guilty party has to be, you have to view them as righteous. You view them both as righteous once the verdict is done. So before the verdict gets decided, guilty, because you're just doing it based on the law. But you're not saying about the person. Once the judgment has to be a clear judgment, you can't be thinking like that. I don't want to hear what you did because you got to judge the case. And so I'm judging it based on the merits, based on what I've seen. I see that you're right, you're wrong, etc. But now that I've given the judgment and you're going to have to pay your fine, your stature has not gone down in my eyes. You know, and so to keep the person, that's a difficult thing to do, but it's what we're supposed to do. And since we're not, none of us are judges or juries, that's surely not our job. Yes?
One of the things that has always been a problem for me is I have an innate nature of being judgmental, making judgments of things that I see.
Welcome to the club.
And I have been, for the last, about the last 8 or 9 months, I've really been working on this issue of not making judgments. And one of the things I found that really helps is because it's often with strangers. I see something and I think, and I found one of the best things to do is I speak to them. And I say something that's affirming to them. And usually the response I get is often surprise, pleasure, and so forth. And I go away from the situation feeling good, and the need to make that judgment goes away.
Wow.
And so that is one of the habits I have really tried to cultivate.
Excellent. It's a great habit, yes.
It's not really much, I guess, but I was very impressed with the little story about the gossiper and the film thing. But I actually shared that with two people to bring the point home about how dangerous and how bad the gossip can be. So that's one little thing.
Beautiful. Wow, we got more response from last week than all of them combined. That's great. It's because it's one of the most important ones. And it's that is really great. Well, tonight kind of continues the themes of what we've been talking about in the past, both philosophically as well as the habit of faith. They're both, this is kind of a continuation. As time is going on, so the spiritual woes that have befallen man are just continuing to degrade. It's just getting, it's getting worse and worse. And the lesson from tonight is connected with unity. Because although this is going to be negative unity, nevertheless, the clear lesson from tonight's lesson is the importance of unity. And so it's kind of on the heels of last week, which is you can't have unity if you see only the flaws in others and stop seeing them as a person. But that you we have to be active about unity. It's not just enough to you know, have good relationships with people around you, but to actually seek unity and to actually pursue unity, to actually go out of your way to create unity. That's really the habit of tonight, even though the topic is obedience to God, but the that's more the philosophical part of this. The habit that we're going to take home habit for tonight is really the concept of unity. But as usual, we'll just go straight to the text here to kind of see it in the text and see the text come alive. How many of you have read this text, which is chapter 11, verses 1 through 9? I mean, I don't mean if you read it today. I mean, if you read it ever in your life, have you ever read the story of the Tower of Babel? It wasn't a... Okay. So then you're familiar with the story. It is a an amazing story. Happened in the year 1796 BCE, to be exact. What was happening in 1796 BCE? Well, this is what was happening. They were building something. Okay. If we just look at the verse before, says, verse 32, which is on page 49, if you're in the book here, these are the families of Noah's descendants according to their generations by their nations, and from these the nations were separated on the earth after the flood. So we have a reference here that these are the people who are after the flood. If you go to the next page, page 51, verse 10, it says, these are the descendants of Shem. Shem was 100 years old when he begot Arpachshad 2 years after the flood. So this little story is kind of sandwiched over here in between, on the one hand, the telling of Noah's family history and family tree all the way down some ways, and then it starts over again with the telling us the nations again. And so it's kind of like, where does it fit? It almost like doesn't fit into this. Where kind of, you know, where did it, what's it doing here exactly? And also, what's the time frame that this happened in? Because if you read it in context here, it would seem to give the implication that it happened around the time of the flood. Because it's all tied into the flood. But yet we know that Abraham was alive at this time. He was 48 years old at the time of the of the building of the tower. And so this was a few hundred years after the flood. But the Torah puts it here and gives us the context of the flood because this is directly related to the flood. So it happens hundreds of years later, but it is related to the flood. So chronologically, it's not close, but the idea and the consequences of the flood are to be seen in this, which is also an interesting way that the Torah kind of puts history before us and says it's hard to see history when you're in it. But from a wide lens, wide picture kind of view, you get to see history in a whole different way. And so from God's perspective, and here God is telling us, that we don't necessarily see the threads that are going on in history, God shows us that really what we think is not connected, it really is connected. And so in this case as well, although the flood happened so many years earlier, the Tower of Babel is connected to it. So what actually did happen? So it says the whole earth was of one language and of common purpose. Okay. What language was that?
Hebrew.
It was Hebrew. Now, the question is, was it the only language that everybody spoke, or was this the unifying language that everybody spoke? So there are different opinions as to whether or not this was the only language that everybody spoke, or did everybody speak their own language? Every country had their own language. There were 70 languages, and it was just that they all had a common language, and that common language was Hebrew, and that what would happen here with the Great Dispersion was that they would lose that common language. And so there's different opinions as to whether or not this is the introduction, this is when languages were introduced, or this is when they lost that common language. It's one or the other. And they were of common purpose. What the common purpose is, it doesn't say. It's mysterious. It doesn't say what the common purpose was. The Hebrew word for common purpose is dvarim achadim. And the Hebrew word achadim means something that unites, which is why they have the translation as common purpose. And so what was bringing them together? What was the common cause that was bringing them together? And so we have three explanations for this in the simple commentary. One is that they wanted to wage war against God. And so they had a common idea, and that was to build a tower and somehow stab God. Make a big tower, somehow get all the way up there, because God is somehow in the skies, and stab him, or kill him. I mean, I don't know how he would kill God, but that was their idea. The other one is that the Hebrew word achadim is a reference to echad, which is one God. So they all came together to commonly wage war against God. So it wasn't that they were building a tower to fight against God, but actually their purpose, their common purpose was to fight against God. And the third answer is that achadim means that they made a calculation. And that calculation was that the flood happened in the year 1656 from creation was when the flood happened. And so they said, once every 1656 years, there is a flood. So let's do something about it. So this way, when another flood comes, we will be saved. So either they were building this so they would be on higher ground so that when the flood would come, it wouldn't be able to reach them, or as Rashi says here, as the commentary says here, that to provide supports for the heaven, that the heavens fall down every 1656 years, global warming or whatever you want to call it, you know, it needs our help, so we're going to make supports. And so they were going to build four supports to hold up the sky, to hold up the heavens, and this one they were going to build in the east. Now, where do you build a support? You need a nice, big, flat, open land. So they went looking for a nice, big, flat land. And so it says, and it came to pass when they migrated from the east, they found a valley in the land of Shinar and settled there. And so the idea here is that everybody came together, the whole earth, all the families mentioned before, and remember, it's only a couple of hundred years since the flood. There were three families that survived. How many people were there at this point? There was quite a few. In 300 years, you get quite a few people from six families, but it was still not an enormous amount of people. And so they all fit in one area. They were all they were all kind of pooled together in Iraq. Modern-day Iraq is where this story takes place. And so they said to one another, verse 3, come, let us make bricks and burn them in fire. And the bricks served them as stone, because in this area there is no stones to build with. And the bitumen, whatever that is, served them as mortar.
Tar-like,
okay. And use it as plaster. And they said, come, let us build us a city and a tower with its top in the heavens. And let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be dispersed across the whole earth. So this kind of is their mission statement. Their mission statement is, let us make a name for ourselves. And the next part of it is, so that we won't be dispersed across the whole earth. Or lest we be dispersed across the whole earth.
Where do you read from that that they wanted to kill God?
No, I didn't say it says anything here about killing God. Oh, before it says common purpose, and that's where we, in other words, it says common purpose. So the word achadim, barim achadim, so that is a reference to that they were trying to kill God.
Can I ask a quick question?
Again, if you read this, I kind of gave you the answer before I tore it apart, but if you read the story, you realize that it's not telling us anything. There is no story here. And a lot of the details that we are being told seemingly are irrelevant. I mean, like they're telling us, the Torah tells us that, come, let us make bricks and burn them in fire. Why don't you tell us a little bit more about what they were trying to do that got God so angry? I mean, God is going to get very angry in a moment, and he's going to just get so angry at because they took, because what were they doing? They were taking bricks, burning them in fire, and not only that, but you should know that they used this tar-like stuff to as mortar. What in the world? Why don't you just tell us a little bit more about what they did wrong? And it doesn't say anything they did wrong. I mean, in the story of the flood, it kind of hints to it. Hamas, it even says, you know, it says that they, people had become immoral, but it doesn't say clearly what they did either. Hishrit called Basar. It just says that they were immoral, but it doesn't say what they did. No specifics. If this is a book of instructions, why don't you give us some instructions? Where are the instructions here? So obviously we believe in what's called the Oral Torah, which is the Midrash, that records what these things mean, and obviously the wording of the Bible is done in such a way that it lends itself to those meanings. So it's not that we're just sticking a story in here, it fills in the pieces here.
I have a quick question on that. Why did they think that if they didn't build this tower, they were going to suddenly be dispersed all over the world?
Oh, this is a great question. So first of all, what does it mean, let us make a name for ourselves? And what is so terrible about making a name for ourselves? And secondly, what were they afraid of? Lest we be dispersed across the whole earth. What would be so terrible about being dispersed across the whole earth? What was wrong with that?
Isolation.
Huh?
Isolation.
What's wrong with that? What's wrong with isolation? Isolation from whom?
They wouldn't be united.
Then they wouldn't be united. Ah. They were afraid of not being united. Well, what's so wrong with that? What's terrible about not being united? Huh?
If you are totally united, there's nothing that's going to keep you from accomplishing what you want to do. Whereas if you're dispersed, you aren't, and there's a collective now working so that you can create some name for yourself.
Let's get back to this in a few moments because it's really the whole subject here. The subject here is, what did they do that was so terrible, and why is it described in this very vague description, seemingly benign. It's a seemingly benign story. All they wanted to do was they We don't want to be scattered. And I don't even know what they were so scared of. What were they so petrified of being scattered or being dispersed? That is exactly what, and it's exactly what happens to them. So obviously their wanting not to be dispersed was something that God was upset about. Right? Because that's what God is going to say. So in the verse 5, so Hashem descended to look at the city and tower which the sons of man built. You know, I keep on meaning to bring that other Bible that I keep on telling you about. Because I really, the translation there is so much better than this one. And here's a good example of that. Sons of man. In the Hebrew it says, B'nei Ha'adam, not B'nei Adam. B'nei Adam means sons of man, which means human people. B'nei Ha'adam means sons of Adam. Mm. Sons of Adam. Big difference. We'll get back to that in a moment. But that's the Gutnik Chumash. It's called Kol Menachem, K-O-L-M-E-N-C-H-E-M. Kol Menachem. It's really a great translation. Because like those kind of nuances where it's B'nei Ha'adam, it's not B'nei Adam, it's not son of man, it's son of Adam. Ha'adam. And Hashem said, verse 6, behold, they are one people with one language for all. And this they begin to do. And now, should it not be withheld from them all they propose to do? Should I not stop them? How could I not stop them? Come, let us descend and there confuse their language, that they should not understand one another's language. And Hashem dispersed them from there over the face of the whole earth, and they stopped building the city. That is why it was called Babel, because it was there that Hashem confused the language of the whole earth, and from there Hashem scattered them over the face of the whole earth. Okay? It is an amazing story, because it's everybody's heard this story. I mean, I heard the story when I was a little kid, but just you read the story, and it's just so many questions come up. It's a simple story, but yet so many very, very basic questions. I mean, look at the end here. So in verse 8 it says, and Hashem dispersed them from there over the face of the whole earth. Okay? He dispersed them already. Then it says, that is why God called it, it was called Babel, because it was there that Hashem confused them, and from there Hashem scattered them over the face of the whole earth. It's a repetition. We know that already. He just said in verse 8, and Hashem dispersed them from there. And it's called Babel because Hashem confused the language. And from there, it's like we already said that.
Isn't it sort of for emphasis when you say it twice?
Yes, it could be for that, but this is not only emphasis, because usually when you emphasize something, you say it one after the other, like right away. So it says, most you must. He will surely die. He should surely die. It's a double expression in the same sentence, right? One right after the other. But in this case, it's one's at the beginning of verse 8, and this is the end of verse 9. It means two different things. And also, what in the world was so upsetting to God? And who is God talking to anyways? Come, let us descend. Right? So first God says, let us descend, and there confuse their language, that they should not understand one another's language. Then it says, it doesn't say, and they dispersed. It says, and God did it. So God does it, so why is he talking to them? Whoever the them is, whoever they are, why is he talking to them? They're not doing it anyways. And he says, let us. The answer to all of this is the habits of faith, the lessons that there are to be learned. Everything here is a lesson for us in how to live our lives today, in today's day and age. This is not a story about the past. If it was a story about the past, it would have been written very differently. But because it's written about a story that happened today, and it's happening right now, so therefore it's written in this language. Because every generation, every single people is supposed to look at this story and go, you know, we might be doing the same thing right now. We need to be careful that we don't commit the exact same thing that they did then. So what did they do? They were using the greatest single powerful thing in the world, and they were using it for something negative. There is nothing in the world that is greater than unity. Nothing. It is the greatest, most powerful thing. Peace, harmony, everybody getting along is the greatest blessing. It is the greatest blessing. Not only is it the greatest blessing, it's the thing that God loves most. The question, the big question that's asked is, if these people were trying to wage war against God, they were trying to kill God, whatever that means, and we'll get to that. Why was God so tame? Why was God so kind? All he did was disperse them? These are people who were trying to kill God. I mean, look what God does to the people of the flood. He wipes them out. Not one shred left of them. Gone. He uproots everything they ever did. There is nothing left of anything that they created. It's gone, destroyed. God destroys not only them, but everything they built. The whole world is gone. And these people, what happens to them? Virtually nothing. It's not even a slap on the wrist. It's just a dispersion. And the answer is, you can actually see it in number 9. If you look all the way in the bottom, there's a little note 9. Rashi queries, whose sin was greater? The generation of the flood, which did not plan a rebellion against God, or the generation of the dispersion, which did? The former, who were robbers and contended with one another, were utterly destroyed in the flood, while the latter, who dwelt amicably in brotherly love toward one another, were spared despite their blasphemies. This demonstrates how hateful is strife and how great is peace. This is how great peace is, that if you are peaceful, even if you are cursing God, fighting God, trying to kill God, you've got God's heart. God is more upset when we fight with one another out of belief. We're fighting for God. We're fighting because of our beliefs. God is much more upset about that than a bunch of people sitting around, and they were all together in this as one people. They were unified. And what was their unifying goal? Was to destroy God. God said, oh, at least they're doing my most favorite thing. They're getting along. It's counterintuitive. It's counterintuitive. But this is God. God is telling us what is most important to him. The most important thing to him is that we get along. Because if you're a believer, but you're fighting with one another, God has no tolerance for that. He destroys the flood. They were all believers. The people of the flood were believers. Much more, much greater believers, although they also lacked in faith, obviously. Otherwise, they would have been acting like that. But they weren't out to wage war against God. They ignored God or didn't care about God, but they weren't waging war against him. These people were outright going to destroy God. And so this is a very, very important lesson that unfortunately is not well known. Could you imagine what history would look like had people paid attention to this? Are you killing each other over what? Over faith? Who are you fighting for anyways? You're fighting for God? Well, God has told us clearly what's most important to him. And what's most important to him is that we get along. Even if what we're getting along for is, unfortunately, the opposite of what God wants. He'd rather that than people believing and fighting. Now, God really wants us to be believing and getting along. That's what God wants. But if you're fighting, don't ever say you're doing it in the name of God. You can't. You cannot. You cannot by any means say that you are doing God's work by fighting and with other people, because God hates strife and loves peace. And the fact that these people were loving each other, were getting along, was therefore they didn't get punished. Therefore they did not get punished. So punishment from God, believe it or not, is dependent on our level of unity. If we get along, the punishment is almost nothing. We don't get along. We're murdering each other. We're stealing from each other. We're fighting with each other. And there's punishment. What I meant is fighting between each other. Those people fighting with each other.
Okay, you say within ourselves, as Christians,
or even with inter-religious or inter-people fighting with each other. For what purpose? If you're self-defense, you're defending yourself. I mean, that's something else. We're not talking about that. And we're not talking about somebody who's taking your land and you're going to try to get back your land. I mean, we're talking about the fighting that goes on. We just fight with one another. We can't care about the other person as another human being. Just unity, getting along. One world together, united. One world, one dream. That was the slogan in Beijing, right? One world, one dream. It's all about one, bringing it all together. And so if we are to take what the Torah is teaching us as a habit of faith, the lesson is very clear, that unity trumps all to a degree. And this is where God got so upset. This is what gets God upset. You're taking my most prized possession. You're taking the thing which means so much to me. It's the most powerful, most blessed thing in the world, called unity. And what are you doing with it? You're going to use it for some common cause that's to make a name for yourself. That's what you're going to use, my greatest gift, my greatest prize, my greatest love, unity. You're going to use that? Oh, that's upsetting. Now, because you're doing such a nice thing, I can't get too upset at you, but I'm still upset. God says, I can't let this go. I cannot allow this to come to pass. So, yes, I am very, very happy when people get together, but you have to get together for a purpose, and that purpose has to be to serve God, not to make yourself a name. Make yourself a name. When did that become a popular thing to do? And so, on the one hand, we're being told a very powerful message that unity trumps all, but at the same time, you've got to use unity carefully. And that is, use it for a godly purpose.
To glorify God.
To glorify God.
So, also important, not only in that, if you take a look at
when Moses came off the mountain. There was unity at the bottom of the mountain. But God wasn't happy that a golden calf that was being built. I mean, they were unified, and yet they were unified not for God's purposes, and it wasn't a very good outcome.
First of all, I don't know that there was unity at all.
You don't think so?
No.
You think with the golden calf there wasn't unity, but there was only a few that were doing that?
Not a few, but it was definitely not the majority. Surely wasn't the majority. Jewish tradition tells us that the women did not participate at all.
Okay.
None of the women participated at all. And of the men, it was a... Yeah, the women have a... We have a special holiday for all the Jewish women. Every beginning of every new month is a special holiday that's designated to Jewish women because of their faith and courage that they showed at that time.
Good. What's that called?
It's called Rosh Chodesh. But besides that, it wasn't all the Jewish people that participated in it.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, it says how many people died when they went around and killed all the people there. It wasn't, 3, it wasn't, 3 million people.
So the women weren't standing against, they weren't standing for it, but they weren't standing against it, or they were actually standing against it?
No, they were approached to donate gold. They refused.
Okay.
They spoke out openly against it. So the women were opposed to it. You don't get a holiday just for... just for standing and not participating. Yeah. Right. So unity is a great thing, but it needs to be used for a godly purpose. Now, to tie this back to what we said before, that Adam and Eve, created by the hand of God. To them, everything was created by God. They saw godliness in everything. Cain already started to think that God was a little bit removed and therefore didn't know exactly what was going on. He had sort of a general observation of the universe. And then you had Enoch, who starts to postulate this idea of, well, you know, what's so terrible about worshiping the sun? After all, God created the sun, and the sun is the most powerful planet, and it also has intelligence. It's an intelligent being, and therefore... we need to acknowledge the great works of the sun and of the moon and of the stars and of the earth and of all the things around us. And that's how idol worship began, not as a substitute for worshiping God, but rather to glorify God. Look at all the great things God created. Let's go worship them as well. Then we get to the story of the flood, where they've gotten to the point where God really doesn't care what we do to one another as long as we're not breaking any of the big ones. As long as we're not breaking any big rules, you know, it's okay to just, you know, walk into someone's house, take their TV, leave, a couple of bucks behind, you know, I didn't steal anything. It's God is not really paying attention to those details. And then we come to the Tower of Babel. And here, they're waging war against God himself. What does it mean to wage war against God himself? It means to say that God is not running the world. God doesn't run this world. Don't you know? God created the laws of nature. It's nature that runs the world, not God. Of course, God created nature. I mean, of course, who doesn't believe that? I mean, we all came from Adam and we know that. But God created nature. And then, now we have the laws of nature. So what's this whole thing of you people believing in this flood, that the flood was somehow related to our actions, that we sort of did something, and therefore we got punished with a flood? That's bogus. That's not true. God is not involved. God is distant. He merely created the world and then went on a long honeymoon. A long vacation, a long-needed retirement. He doesn't care about what goes on. You want to know why there was a flood? We have a weak sky. And every 1,656 years, the sky falls down. It's just the laws of nature. And in 1,656 years, it will fall again. Whether we do good or don't do good, it's not reliant, it doesn't matter what we do. What's important is that we have supports for the sky, or we have an escape route, or we have a high enough tower to climb upon so that we will be saved from this oncoming natural disaster. This is waging war against God. This is how you kill God. How do you kill God? You kill God by saying, oh, thanks for creating nature. What do you mean creating nature? I am nature. I'm also a miracle. I'm everywhere. I am everything. What are you doing? You're saying that God doesn't, he created a rock he can't lift? God created the laws of nature and walked away? That's terrible. And so this idea of them waging war against God is really just giving a scientific explanation for everything that happens in the world. In other words, if we come up with a scientific explanation for everything in life, then where's God? What is God? He's simply just he gets credit for starting it all.
And for some, their science is their God. They just sort of lay stuff from the equation and make it the science.
Well, that would happen later on. In other words, this didn't happen right away, but it happened probably 300 years ago when, with Bible criticism and with other things that came along, there all of a sudden became this substitution for God. We don't need God anymore. All these explanations that we needed to explain floods and to explain natural disasters, that's because we weren't scientific enough. So we had no explanation. We had no good explanation for why these things happen, and so therefore we said, an act of God, right? It's in all of your insurance policies, right? Everyone, right? Act of God, right? It says it in your, they're all big believers, I tell you. Every insurance company is big believers, because in every one of your policies it says if there's an act of God, okay? Why is it called an act of God? Because they couldn't explain it. But we can explain it. We know, we understand how the cosmos works. We understand how comets work. We understand what happens and how the world came about. We don't even need a God to create the world. You don't need a God for that. You only need a God for that if you're a I don't want to use any bad words here. If you are a simple-minded, foolish believer who doesn't know anything about science and about how worlds are created. But we, scientists, we know. We have substituted God. There's no need for a God anymore. That's a great way to kill God. So this is what the Tower of Babel is. The Tower of Babel is really the precursor and the attitude that leads to these kind of impressions. Now, the idea of science replacing God is just as ludicrous as religious people not believing in science. I mean, it's ludicrous. The whole thing is ludicrous, but it's ridiculous for someone to believe that science somehow makes God irrelevant. If anything, in today's day and age, science has uncovered and has proven that there is definitely a force out there. There is something out there that science cannot understand. And science is finally coming to its limits and realizing that there's something out there. And it's very difficult to, at this time, ignore or even deny that science somehow replaces God. It doesn't. It simply is an understanding of the world that we live in, but it doesn't replace God. But there is a tendency among people to do this. Why? Why is it? Why? Why are we looking to replace God with science? The answer is very simple. Then you don't have to have habits of faith. You don't have to do anything. You don't have to do anything. Who was the one who was leading this entire project?
Nimrod.
Very good. How do you know it was Nimrod?
and...
Where?
No, it talks about how he was a mighty hunter and he wanted to build a city.
Yeah, but how do you know it was this city?
Well, because it's in this part of the story.
Oh.
Right? That's why we got them together.
That's called the Oral Torah. So the Oral Torah tells us that it was Nimrod who was the
king.
Who was the king at this time. And who was Nimrod? He was a descendant of our very good friend, Ham, his great-great-grandson. So Nimrod is a grandchild of Ham, who we already know his actions and the way his heart and mind work. And here is his grandson with the name Nimrod. What does the word Nimrod mean? Nimrod means to rebel against. Who did he rebel against? He was rebelling against God. That was his name. His name was to rebel against God.
Is Nimrod a Hebrew name?
Yeah. Nimrod means to rebel against God. And so here you have a man by the name of Nimrod who's rebelling against God. And what's his rebellion against God? His rebellion against God, interestingly enough, is, let's stay here. This was something that had been passed down from Adam and been passed down by Noah, and that was that God wanted the world populated. It says that God wanted... one-third or two-thirds of the world populated. And so I read a commentary today saying, but if you count up the whole earth, every part of the earth that's populated, and you put it all together, it doesn't even come close to a third, let alone two-thirds. And so he explains that it has to do with the roads in between. But the roads in between kind of stretch the area of living. So it kind of stretches the area of living when there's roads there to and from. And so the fact that people would be dispersed and would live in different places. As a matter of fact, we have a tradition, and our tradition is that Adam, not only did he name all the animals, but he also chose the demographics, or the geography, I should say, of the world. And he decided where people were going to live and what was going to be open space. So it was Adam who was the first association. City planner. And so that's why if you look at a map, it really is interesting where people live. It is the strangest thing. I mean, look at Las Vegas, you know. You're driving everywhere. I mean, why didn't they pick over here? Why not over there? Why over here? You know, how did it all come about? And everything has, obviously, there are reasons behind it, but there could have been just equal reasons to move somewhere else. But for some reason, these places have just become these metropolises. You know, and same thing, you look along the coast. Look along the California coast, right? Everybody wants to live on the coast, but yet there's just pockets here, pockets there of where people are actually living. Here, there's nobody living. Why here they're living, there they're not living? It's just an interesting thing, and from a Jewish perspective, or from the Talmud perspective, Adam already picked it. So Nimrod, part of his others is, hey, wait, we're going to do this differently. We don't have to follow someone else's protocol. We can do this ourselves. We can set a different course. So Adam said you have to live and populate two-thirds of the world because God said so, and Noah said the same thing, but we don't have to listen. When I was in high school, we did a play, and it was a play about this spaceship that was that the United States was going to be sending to, it was Alpha Centauri, and it was going to take more than one lifetime. And so they were looking for a family to, you know, that would, you know, kind of go on the spaceship and have children on the spaceship, and then those children would finally make it all the way, all the way there. And so, they find, a really, really dedicated couple to science that basically can live the rest of their life in a spaceship and go all the way to, Alpha Centauri, and they'll never make it there. They're never going to make it there, but their children have to raise their children in a spaceship. And so they get on there, and they have all their supplies for, 200 years, and they have enough food, and they have enough everything that they need, and they have videos of Earth, and they have videos of, and so they get on there, and they have children, and their children grow up, and they show them videos, and they tell them about their purpose, and why they're here, and what they're doing, and the father's getting older, and the mother's getting older, and the kids are like, what in the world are we doing? What are we doing? We're on our way to some crazy, let's stop here. We have there's some kind of planet over here. Let's take over this planet. Why are we going all the way there? And he says, obviously the father, finds out about it, and he gets all upset, and he starts to talk to them, and the context of it was the way we did the play was that it turned out that the couple that was chosen was a Jewish couple, and before he went on, he was not very religious, and some rabbi came to talk to him, and he said, this old belief of the Torah, come on, we live in the 21st century, come on, we did this, we don't need all those old books and those old things, and come on, we have a new path, we don't have to go there anymore, we're here, we have arrived. And then as when his children rebel against him, it comes home to, he realizes what just happened, and he gathers his kids around and he says, okay guys, let's forget about Alpha Centauri for a second here, let me tell you all, you're all Jewish. You're really Jewish, and we have a Torah, and we have a God, and we have Moses, and he tries to talk to them, and then they go, oh, okay, now we can, and they connect, and it's a, obviously it was a play, and beautiful, always end in a beautiful ending, and they lived happily ever after, and they made it to Alpha Centauri and back. Yeah. Anything could happen in a play, right?
Yeah.
And so, the idea is that, Adam is given a purpose, given a plan, and then slowly but surely it's like, we don't have to do that plan. Let's make our own plan. Why? Because he said so. Because Adam said so. Because Adam said he saw God. Because Adam said he was created by God. I mean, we live in today's day and age. We don't have to do that. And so that's why they say to each other, come, let us make bricks and burn them in fire. What is a brick? Brick is man-made. They didn't have any stones. A stone is God-made. And so the details are very important. It's all about bricks. It's all about man. Concrete. We build. We are. Let's make a name for ourselves. This is us. This is who we are. We stand for something. We don't have to live for someone else or for something else or for some God. We live for ourselves. And so here is for the first time that they were really making a break with this chain of tradition that they had from Adam to Noah, and now it was being broken at this time. And what were they afraid of? They were afraid that they would be scattered. Now there's two explanations here. One explanation is they were afraid of being scattered, and then some people might start believing again. So if we hold everybody together, everybody stay here, because if God, God is going to divide and conquer, right? God is going to separate us out, and then we'll fight with each other. But right now, we're all united in this one idea against God. So we're like invincible. So if we all stay together, we'll be invincible. God will not be able to penetrate us. Don't let God in. Let's form a circle and not let God in. And so they kind of form a circle. Second answer is that they actually looked at unity and they realize, this is a very deep mystical concept. And a deep mystical concept is that these people wanted to get spiritual energy without having to do what God wants. And I will give you the example of the difference between spirituality and godliness. Today, spirituality is very popular. Being spiritual is very popular. It's really in. And we find, pop stars are really getting into Kabbalah, and they're getting into mysticism, and they're getting into spirituality. And there really is. I mean, there are tons of books on it, and it's a whole new culture. It's the new age kind of religion, we can call it. It's called spirituality. It's just being spiritual. And so we have all different types of things that go along with being spiritual. It's yoga, meditation, all sorts of things that are spiritual in nature, but they're not necessarily godly. They're spiritual. They're of the spirit. And so spirituality actually is close to godliness, but it isn't godliness. You can use it as a great tool to get close to God, or you could stop short and just use it for yourself. And so on a deep mystical note here, what they were saying was, let's stay together, have this unity, and have the spiritual energy that we get from unity. Because they see, if we're not unified, we won't get any spiritual energy. We'll all have to become religious in order to get the spiritual energy. But like this, we can just stay unified and we'll get that spiritual energy and we won't have to do anything. And so this is the difference between spirituality and godliness. That spirituality is wonderful as long as it's a stepping stone as a tool to getting close to God. But if it is just to make ourselves a name, then it is the Tower of Babel. And so God looks at it and says, wow, that one language and that unity, they're misusing it. I gave them this gift. I gave them a common language. You know what kind of a gift that is? You know what a gift it is that you can all speak the same language? And if you think about it, we're kind of in that environment today. English has become a uniting language. It's a language that almost is taught in almost every country. If you want to do anything on a computer, you need to have some knowledge of English. And there is, the internet has become a unifying force. There's a lot of unity in the world. You know, the Olympics are just over. We have how many? What, 200 and something? How many? 204 nations participating in coming together. You have the UN, United Nations. All these nations coming together. But what are they coming together for? What are they coming together for? Are they coming together to do something with purpose? Are they coming together to do something which is godly? Or are they coming together to do something which is pagan? Something which is immoral or amoral? And so it really has a profound message for any time, any age, and especially ours. Because our generation has a unique opportunity. The unity that we can create in today's day and age with the internet is unprecedented. Unprecedented in history, well, except for this time when they all got together, right? Somehow, they had a few people, but somehow these guys managed to get it to, I don't know what they use, what technology they use, but they managed to all stay together. Maybe they only had 10 people or something, no. They had a lot of people, and they managed to all come together on one with one cause. But today, With the internet, you can really get millions and millions of people behind something, together on something. And so the onus is on us. The onus is on us to create a unity with purpose, to create unity with a godly purpose, not a pagan purpose, an amoral or immoral purpose, but with a godly purpose. And so how do we do that? We are just small people, tiny people in an enormous world. How can I make a difference? How am I to make a difference in this world? I watch the Olympics, but I do support the UN, I don't support the UN. But these are all big things. I mean, this is world stuff. Well, let's talk about me and you. What can we do? And so the answer is we are all one. All people around the world are one. What you do affects other people. What we do to people affects four people. But three people, four people, five people, the more people coming together, changing the way they think, creating a unity that encompasses all. It's not a unity that includes us. See, that's where we go wrong. We start creating unity within groups. It's called group unity. We're all unifying around this. And all those are here are in. All those out, out. As opposed to creating a unity of world, a world unity. One world. And truly caring about other people, unifying with other people, and thinking of them in our thoughts, in our minds, in our actions. And so tonight, I would like to focus on a habit which would be a really nice habit, and that is the habit of giving charity. I'm sure everyone here is familiar with the concept of charity. The Hebrew word for charity is tzedakah, which means justice, righteousness, something that we need to do. And so as a society, and America has definitely been in the has done a tremendous amount in this regard. They spent $40 billion on the Olympics in Beijing. $40 billion. They spent $300 million on the opening ceremonies. And people are complaining that America is spending too much money on trying to help people around the world. Nobody is complaining that they spent $300 million. Everybody enjoyed it. If you didn't see the opening ceremonies, you got to see it. I mean, unbelievable, most amazing show in the history of the world, almost as big as the Tower of Babel. the bird's nest, right? With these fireworks coming out. I mean, this is something. No one's complaining about it. No one's saying anything about it. But America, you know, we spend money on this or that. What are we doing? We should be spending money. America has been really the guiding light to the nations of the world of what you do with your wealth. When America had the Olympics, we didn't spend no $40 billion to fix up L.A. We didn't spend that kind of money. We didn't spend that kind of money on our opening ceremonies. We have other priorities. Our priorities are helping people around the world, that are not even our country, to go there and then give out the school books to children to make sure that they can go, that they can have running water, they can have things that they need. This is America. This is our guiding light. So how do we incorporate that? How do we incorporate that into our life. And so we have a concept called a charity box. And therefore, we don't wait till we go to, I'm sorry that she's not here tonight, but we don't wait till we go to a religious place, or we go to worship, or we go to pray, and then give charity. We have charity boxes everywhere, and we give charity boxes, we give to charity at all times. And so tonight, I have decided that I'm going to give a gift to everybody who's here. It's a very small charity box, and this can be placed in your car, which is a nice place. We recommend having one in your place of work, in your car, in your house, in your vacation house. Wherever you are, wherever you go, charity becomes a part of your life. And this way, you don't have to wait for somebody to come knocking on your door, excuse me, I'm starving to death. No, it's part of my daily routine that I think about other people. What do I do to think about other people? I take some of my own money and I put it in a charity box. What am I going to do with the charity box? I don't know. I'll find some needy organization or some needy person, and I'll give it there. But the main thing is, while I'm on vacation somewhere, while I'm on a road trip somewhere, what am I doing? I'm thinking about somebody else. Who that person is, I don't even know. And I'm not giving it because right now someone is making me feel so guilty. Oh, they're so, oh, look at that. Oh, poor thing. Oh, I've got to give some money to that. No, nothing is making me feel pitiful or feeling sympathetic at this moment. I'm just feeling disconnected from people. I got to do something to connect myself to other people. What am I going to do? Well, let me take a couple of coins. It's not how much you give. It's that you give. And that you give all the time in a different place, in a different circumstances. It's always on your mind. And so the habit of today is everyone is going to get a little... it's called a tzedakah box. Beautiful design, Hebrew word tzedakah. And you'll take that with you, and you'll put it in your car, you'll put it in your home, put it wherever you need to put it. And hopefully you'll look to getting more. I'm only giving you one tonight. But hopefully this will inspire you to try to get more. They come in all different shapes, sizes. They're beautiful designs. They're very simple designs. You can just take any container and just put a cap on it and cut out the top so it becomes a charity box. And it's just I remember my grandmother, God bless her, she should have long, healthy years, back of her house, big cabinet filled with these from every different type of organization where you have one. And every Friday she'd go to the back there and put a little bit in each one. And once a month or once every couple of months they would come around to kind of collect the change and give her a receipt. And that was her ritual. And she didn't just do it on Fridays. Every day she had them all over the house. But on Friday she would go through this cabinet and there were, I don't know, must have been hundreds of these boxes there, and she would just put in every single one. And so that's the culture that we need to create. And it's really the culture that America really stands for, but now we're just taking it to a whole other level. Because as great as what we do is, we individually need to increase our habits of faith. And this is one of the greatest habits of faith, which is the giving of charity. And so you should have one in your place of work. You should have one in your car. Have one in your house. Have it wherever you can, and have as many as you can. And therefore, whenever you can, try to put in a penny in the can. Oh, very nice. Any questions, comments? Yes.
Isn't the Olympics kind of a bad example? Because individuals go to the Olympics not to give anything. They go there to prove themselves better than anybody else in the world in a particular event. And you try to watch the Olympics on television, and the national broadcasting system has so many commercials that they want to get money from. It's almost a false... I think false advertising is that you're going to show the Olympics, because in between the fluff and the commercials, you don't see many events.
Yeah, watch it online. That's the answer.
Yeah, watch it.
They don't show any. No, right, no. No, the problem is,
see, how many gold medals was won by which country? And they're all listed. Mm-hmm. You know.
So I didn't want to really get into the Olympics because I want to leave on a happy note. But let's put it this way. Again, the Olympics is really a pagan, it really comes from, gods of the Olympian. You know, this is not, it's kind of, I'll say it because I can say it to this crowd, it's embarrassing that Jewish people participate in the Olympics. What it stands for is everything, it's antithetical to everything we stand for. It is just the opposite of Judaism. And anybody who's familiar with the story of Hanukkah? The story of Hanukkah is the miracle of the Jews over the Olympics. That's who won. The Olympics were the big gymnasium that they built. They tried to turn the temple into a gymnasium. They had a big gymnasium next to it. That's why they ran around naked with all their, showing off their bodies. I mean, that's where this was from. This is where this comes from. So it really is, like I say, I watch the Olympics. I, get caught up in the fact, America winning their gold medals and everything. But I always am aware that this is real paganism. And, that's what it is. And so is so much more of our society, and so much more of our culture is also that. So, hey, we're indulging in that. Why not indulge in this too? I mean, it's not like Monday Night Football is any holier or that much. But but hey, you got to give yourself a good time too. Come on, it's not as long as we don't start worshiping it. That's where it becomes. When we start to lose perspective on things, and we start to think that the Olympics is it or sports is it. That's where it becomes a problem. Someone keeps reminding us that, hello, it's paganism. Okay, now at least I've been brought down to earth, and I remember, and I'm clear as to what this really is about. And if you think about it, here are people who have spent months, years, training, focusing their attention, and it truly is amazing. I am always amazed at the physical feats, almost like what these people here in the Tower of Babel did. The parallel is pretty amazing. What they started to build was unbelievable. I mean, according to the Midrash, they built this thing so high, higher than any skyscraper that we have ever built. And it was giant. It could fit the entire population of the world at that time. Every human being of that time could go into that tower. I mean, that's what the Midrash describes it as. So this was a physical, structural feat that still has yet to be replicated. It has not been replicated since. And so, wow, it is amazing what we humans can do with our body, with the things that God has given us, which is amazing. But to what end? To what end is it? How about if we had Olympics, or we won't call it Olympics, we'll have to call it something else, but how about if we had something of personal growth? Of people who had, who had become like Hillel, the sage Hillel, who no one could anger him. He won the gold medal in humility. The Talmud tells a story of two fellows who were having a bet. And one said to the other, that sage Hillel, they say that you can't get him angry. So the fellow said, well, if you give me 200 zuz, I can get him angry. He said, okay, fine, you get him angry, I'll give you 200 zuz. So he goes to Hillel on a Friday afternoon, right before the Sabbath. Everybody's rushing, getting ready for the Sabbath. And he waits till he fills up the bath with the hot water. And as soon as he's kind of standing outside his house, and he hears he's about to get into the bath, he starts screaming, Hillel, Hillel, anybody know where that guy Hillel lives? In a very disrespectful way. Hillel comes out, gets dressed quickly, runs out, the Jew needs the help, and so he comes out and says, Rabbi, I got a pressing question, very important question. Really, what's your question? Oh, my question is, how come the Chinese, their eyes are slanted? This is Hillel's answer. That's a very important question. Let me think about that for a moment. Well, the answer is that they live in sandy conditions where there's a lot of windstorms, and so it's better for them in that condition. Okay. Guy says, thank you so much. You've been so helpful, Rabbi. And so he goes back. By this time he gets back to the bath is now cold. Now he heats up the water again, and he's waiting, waiting. Finally, he fills up the bath again. He gets undressed, about to get in there. He starts shooting again. Hello, hello. Where's that guy? Hello, I got a very important question. He gets dressed. He comes out again, and he says to him, you know, why is it that the I forget which country it is? Why do they have flat feet? Very important question. Let me think about this. Strokes his beard, and he tells them it's because they live in very wet environments, so they need flatter feet, so it's easier for them to walk around. Comes to the third time, and he does the same thing, and again asks some ridiculous question, why their foreheads are flat, or why this is flat, or that. And Hillel is it, you know, that's a very important question. Doesn't even show a hint of this. So finally, the guy says to him, you know, I hope and pray that there will never, ever be born another Jew like you. Hillel says, What did I ever do that you would give me such a curse? He says, because of you, I lost 200 zuz. I made you lose 200 zuz. He says, yeah, I bet that I could get you angry, and if I could get you angry, I would get 200 zuz, but I couldn't get you angry, so now I've lost 200 zuz. And Hillel says, well, if that's the case, you could lose 200, 400, 1,000 zuz. You're not going to get me angry. That was Hillel. Hillel was the epitome of humility. He gets a gold medal. The only thing is, you don't give gold medals to humility, right? That doesn't equate. But we should have that, where we work on our character for 4 years. Now let's see what you can do with your character. I don't get angry anymore. I'm now a kind person. I'm not judgmental anymore. I'm kind. I'm giving. I look at other people's flaws and I don't see them. I just see the person. And I'm able to counsel people without getting caught up into who they are. I am living a meaningful life. I'm not getting caught up by the materialism. I'm not distracted by all the things in the world. I am focused. I've been practicing for 4 years, for 40 years, my whole life. Because it's not an event that happens once every 4 years. This is my life. This is my habit of faith. This is how I connect with God. This is what we should be focusing on. This should be capturing the attention of our children, of our youth. Not that they should go and try to get a ball into a little tiny basket. That's good for recreation. But don't spend your whole life on it. That's not your goal in life. Your goal in life is the personal growth. You're changing as a person. Swimming is a wonderful thing. But being able to swim through the drowning materialism that we have, and all the things in the world around us, now that is what the young people in this world should be doing. We should be showcasing these kind of people. We have now found a person who has now, it's been 40 years, and he has not said one word of gossip. We must introduce this person. Let's interview this person. How do you do it? How have you done it for 40 years not said one word of gossip? Wow, that must be so difficult. Yeah, it is. Yeah, I've been practicing for a long time. I mean, this is the kind of interviews I'd like to see. Here's the most charitable person in the world who's giving almost every penny he has to charity. How does that feel? Oh, feels great. Yeah, I'm loving it. It's great. This is the kind of things we should be having. These are the kind of games that they should be paying millions and millions of dollars to broadcast on the on national broadcasting company. That's what they should be showing, right? Then you know Mashiach is here. Then you know the Messiah is here, when those are the kind of shows that everybody wants to see, and no one's interested in seeing, how far somebody can jump or how fast they can run. Those are the good. Now that you've gotten the discipline from that, now you can now use that discipline in your own personal life of being a good husband, being a good father, being a good person, being a good citizen. That's that's the kind of energy we need to have. And I realize I missed something out here, so I'd like to just tie up this loose end here. And I kind of reminded myself as I was getting all caught up in the Olympics there. God says, let us descend. And I didn't explain that. And so God is teaching us a lesson, and that is humility. God's humility is that he tells us that he talks to his cabinet members, even though he doesn't have any cabinet members, and they can't do anything anyways. They all do everything he says anyways. But he talks to them so that we, who think we're God and think we don't have to talk to our cabinet, or we just have to bark orders at them, whether it be our family, whether it be our coworkers, or other people around us in the world, to know you need to include other people. Even if you're the one who has the last say, make them be a part of it. Bring them in. And so this is God's lesson to us of humility, of how we should treat one another. And so God is even willing to take a risk that people will misinterpret this as some kind of polytheistic reference or some other kind of reference. God is willing to take that risk so that we will learn this lesson. And that lesson is that we should be humble, because of God, who is truly supreme and truly does have the last word and truly is controlling everything. If he consults the people and angels or cabinet that he created, how much more so we, who are on the same level with other human beings, should treat them in a similar fashion. Are there any other questions?
Just one quick thing on the, on the Olympics. Did I hallucinate when I heard that they could, the Chinese could control the pixels in your television? Anybody hear that? Okay, well, we'll talk about that in a I know I heard that. But could you...
Those are the ones that are manufactured in China. They can control those.
Thank you for getting me out of that one. But could you, again, outline the difference between godliness and...
spirituality?
Yes.
Spirituality is the pursuit of something of the spirit for your own, to make a name for ourselves, for your own personal growth. Your own personal, you know, so some people enjoy a good steak. Some people enjoy a nice piece of art. Some people enjoy a beautiful, you know, orchestra. Those are higher forms of enjoyment. And some people enjoy being spiritual. That makes you really feel good. So if you want to feel good, you can go to an art gallery, or you can go to a symphony concert. You know, or you can go and, you know, and become more spiritual. So spirituality is simply another form of self-fulfillment, of self-enjoyment, as opposed to godliness, which is serving God. That's what it is. So as long as it's serving God and having a relationship with God, it's godly. If it's not, then it's about you. And so spirituality, in and of itself, does not tell us if it's godly or not. It feels godly. So that's what's so exciting about it and why it's so delicious and enjoyable, because it feels godly. It's got that, it's that faux leather look. You know, it looks like God. It looks like, but it's not. And so it's very tricky and very confusing. So people confuse the two. They feel like, you know, if I'm getting into it, if I'm having this experience, oh, it must be godly, you know. If there's no experience, then it's not godly. Not necessarily so. You could have no experience and it's very godly, and you could be having a great experience and it's not godly at all. So it's tricky. It really is tricky.
Okay.
So if you know you're relating and connecting to God and you're serving God, then It doesn't matter if you're feeling it or not feeling it. Whether you experience it, that's your pleasure on your end. Whether it's godly is God's pleasure on his end. So what are you doing it for? Are you doing it for you or for God? Now, it's possible to have an experience while you're doing something for God, which is wonderful. But the experience is not godly. It's that you did something for God that makes it godly. The experience is sort of the bonus that that comes along with it. Yes?
The New Agers, you know, they'll light their candles and burn their incense and, you know, sit in a meditative pose. And in a lot of it, they are seeking themselves to become like God, be God, and have this kind of, I did a study on the New Age, and they're really trying to be God, so we can become God. And that is one of the very seriously...
So I never talk about groups. Mm-hmm. I always talk about myself. And so, to me, New Agers, they may be an extreme, but we all suffer from the same malady. At least I know.
That's an extreme.
And again, the reason we see them is because they're a mirror. Mm-hmm. Okay. They're the mirror. So when we look at them, we go, "Ugh, that's horrible. I don't do that." Maybe I do. I just stop it. Mm-hmm. Look how horrible it looks. Look how terrible it is. And then that's me. That's a mirror of me. That's me. Okay, so I don't do it so, you know, exaggerated. It's not so open and so clear for everyone to see. Mine is much more subtle. It's much more subtle, and therefore, I'm holy. I am great because I am so much better than they because they are so foolish because they do it. Theirs is so pronounced. Mine is so much more subtle. What difference does it make? You have it too, and that makes it worse because you don't think it's a problem. They might come one day and realize that they made a mistake because it's so extreme. But you will never come out of your dreamlike state because you think you're perfect, as we talked about before, because it's so subtle. And you don't notice that, and so you only see it in others. And so to me, everything that goes on in the world, whether it be the Olympics and seeing somebody do that or whatever it is, every time I see a complaint or a frustration, I just look at it and go, yeah. I guess I'm a little too much into that myself. Maybe I'm a little bit like that. Or maybe I'm a lot like that. And I'm just... And the reason I saw this and the reason it bothers me is because it's really in there. It's really inside of me, and I need to correct that. So just wanted to... I don't want to pick on any New Agers or anybody like that because I don't pick on anybody because anybody I pick on is really me. And I'm not saying it in a... I'm just saying, these are great examples for us. So everything we look around in the world and we see such negativity in the world, whoa, yikes, I got a lot of negativity in me. I got a lot of work to do. And I thought I was so perfect. Why did I come to the Rabbi Marcus' class? I thought I was so good before I came here. My goodness, this has been the most... Jesse, why did you get me to come to this thing? I mean, the rabbi gets up here and just tells us how lousy we are and terrible. I thought it was perfect and fine and good and godly and... Yeah. Last question. Do we have a last question? We don't. Well, I just want to conclude before we give out the little tzedakah boxes to everyone. This has been a wonderful journey for me. I've enjoyed it. But most importantly, my habits have also changed. Because the more you talk about this, even if you know it, even if you've just said it before or heard it before or said it before, it's not something that you close the book now and, oh, yeah, we finished the first, six classes of the JBSC. I mean, we covered Genesis. We didn't cover anything. All we uncovered was, we uncovered that we have work in this area, and that area, and this area, and that area, and life is a work in progress. And we all need to be reminded and be supported and be given the encouragement, inspiration, to do and to work and to continue in the wonderful work that we do and to do it even better. And so I want to thank you all for making this possible, but especially to Jesse for putting this together, sending out those emails, putting this on CD so that people can actually have a, listen to it again and again, and hopefully pass it on to others who will, who this will be, like you said, telling the story, you know, the ripple effect. And from here, we make the world a brighter, better, and most importantly, a more godly place. Thank you very much. Have a good night.
Thank you.